Hello. 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 I am the ghost of Daniel Johnston. Many years ago, I lived in Austin, Texas, and I worked at McDonald's. It is an honor and a privilege to speak to you today. To tell you about my condition and the other world.
Ladies and gentlemen, the best singer-songwriter alive today, Daniel Johnston.
Come this far and I know I can make it. Got a broken heart and you can't break a broken heart. I come knocking at your door. You don't love me anymore, but I just can't give up, 'cause I don't know what to do about it. You must be wrong if you think you don't love me. You could smile down and put a happy ending to my song. I come knocking at your door. You don't live there anymore. Is it just a memory? Or am I a little crazy for you?
He was different. I noticed that from the start, that Dan was different. I had him on a crib in a little bedroom, and I would go in and talk to him, change his diaper, and I would squeal at him, and he would squeal back at me. That's a small baby communicating, I thought.
Being 6 years younger than his four brothers and sisters, he was pampered by them, and they nursed him along. But we didn't notice at that time that there was any special talents involved or anything.
When he went to school, they tested the kids, and Dan was put in the highest group of the highest class. His teacher was really mad at him, and it's understandable because Dan doesn't follow directions. You know, when he was in junior high, he suddenly lost all his wonderful confidence, and I guess it was the beginning of his illness.
Well, he and his brother decided to make their own movie. And it was a collaborative effort between the two brothers working together. And Dan had to change clothes and pretend to be his mother, because his mother and I weren't in the movie, actually.
Tell about it, Mabel.
Dan is the director and the actor portraying himself in parts and his horrible mother in other parts. I think he was having fun teasing me. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, he was doing it for humor.
Dan's hard to deal with sometimes. He thought, I'm artistic, I shouldn't have to do those things. Time to get up and get ready for school.
Get up and our breakfast is ready.
He wanted to be comic all the time. He just couldn't get over it.
Okay.
They were having too good a time. I don't think his relationship with me was typical.
How you doing?
Do you suppose he really pictured me that way? This is ridiculous, what they're showing. I think it's popcorn in green Kool-Aid. He was a trial.
I was sort of the star art guy at the high school, Oak Glen High School. And I started hearing rumors of this new art guy, the new art star. You know, the new kid in town. I had to find out who this was. A friend of mine told me, this kid, Dan Johnston, he can really draw. He's a musician or something. So he kind of had one up on me. He was a musician. The guy is a natural, an absolute natural. He never even had to learn to draw. He just got better from great. You know, I had to hang out with this guy. I had to be around this art. So we just started hanging out and doing art together, actually.
Thank you.
See, real life. Check it out.
The eyeball thing was sort of like his intro calling card.
Did it touch you emotionally?
It was his mysterious entry.
It's definitely different.
I'm speechless.
Everybody was like, who's the eyeball guy? You know, he's painting these eyeballs everywhere. He would actually draw on walls all over the high school.
I thought Vans was very imaginative.
Daniel's he just exudes art. He can't stop making one.
Art show. Please come to the art show. Art show. Art show.
He never sits and thinks, what am I going to do? He just grabs something.
And I'll tell a story about an artist growing old. Some would try for fame and glory, others aren't so bold. Everyone and friends and family saying, hey, get a job. Why do you only do that only? Why are you so odd? We don't really like what you do. We don't think anyone ever will. It's a problem that you have, and this problem's made you ill. The artist walks alone. Someone says behind his back, he's got his gall to call himself that. He doesn't even know where he's at.
He wasn't buying them for comic books. He was buying them for the artwork that was involved on the comics. And some of the artists were his incentive to try to be an artist himself. They were inspiration to him.
I'll talk about the cinema of Daniel Johnston then. He doesn't have influences. He doesn't sit down and consciously watch Chaplin and then learn, or this is my Keaton period. It's not like that. He doesn't even know who these guys are. You know, he gets a Super 8 and he makes a movie.
Dan took himself seriously. He, for some reason, thought he was going to be an artist because probably of the attention he got. The family room would sometimes be almost full of kids, and one of them told me that he's going to be famous someday. And I thought, that's silly stuff, you know?
He lived in the basement of his parents' house. They got this perfectly normal ranch house out in the country behind New Cumberland. He's got this amazing lab, like this amazing factory downstairs. He's turned a garage and two sort of utility rooms into a bedroom and a art factory, and he's just got everywhere, magazines, tapes. In fact, he's recreated it in Waller, where he lives today. It's a duplicate of the same room.
I was guilt-stricken to go away. She turned without saying, I could not stay. And all the while, she was smiling at me like I was a show on her TV.
They're sort of like this Christian fundamentalist Glass family. They're creative, they're intellectual, but there's this like West Virginia kind of right-wing Christian thing. Daniel wasn't having any of it. Spiritually, he was separated from them. Socially, every other way, he was gone from them. But at the same time, he was of them in the sense that he had certain material to draw from.
Bill and I both thought he was doing too much concentrating on the art and the music, and he wasn't having a well-rounded life.
She would constantly trying to get him, go to church and save yourself. He just would have none of it. He'd go to church even, but he wouldn't participate. He'd go to church so he could stare at the girls. Try to find a girlfriend. Literally, all he cared about was making art and being John Lennon. And his parents' rules were in the way of that, all he wanted them to do was just keep the lights on, keep the power on so he could draw.
Dan was getting to be a problem, and he wanted to do everything, but he didn't want to do any of his chores, like help mow the lawn or wash the car or any of those things. And I thought he was lacking in training. I had to settle that.
Every bit of the supposed persecution that Daniel portrays in early music was there, but I'm not saying it was without provocation. He did it. He brought it on himself. He would cause it to tape record, to film. Many times, Mabel would open the basement stairs door, and she used to call him an unprofitable servant. You're an unprofitable servant of the Lord. You need to leave the house and get a job. And he turned it, he used to call himself an unserviceable prophet.
We are the producer, great big lazy folks. And you have no shit, and you like it that way. You're an unprofitable servant. What do you contribute? Well, Dan, we're contributing 10% of our earnings, and we're working hard for our earnings. We aren't unprofitable. Even if you earn money, you won't contribute to God. And you love it that way.
I really didn't like it when he taped me giving him what for. I didn't think he would do that.
She would really harangue him, and he it was hard on him. It was. But he's this sort of like coal burning in the basement, you know, and it's heating up the whole house, and they're just going insane from it. So the whole place is just going wild because he is just such a problem.
When the problem became apparent was when he first went to college at Abilene Christian College, and he wasn't getting to his classes. He was totally confused, and we thought, well, this is homesickness, you know. And they sent him to the local doctor to see if he was complaining about pains in his arms, which are symptoms of manic depression.
I mean, I don't know what's going on here. It's like, it's not even real. I can't believe it. Like, in my hands now, I can feel it in my fingers, and I can feel it in my toes now, my feet. I don't think this is arthritis. This is something else, really, and it's happening so quick, you know?
He's going around in a daze. We said, well, we better bring him home. And immediately he snapped out of it and then back to being a normal person again. We thought, well, everything's all right. So we sent him to a local college.
He goes to art school, Kent State University branch in East Liverpool, Ohio. And I am attending the same school. We found all these kind of lethargic professors and sort of half-talented students. And Daniel, of course, he just scoops them up and he just mixes them into his art form. Like, everybody's his subject, you know. He's all of a sudden he's interviewing people with his little tape recorder and then taking little phrases from them and cutting them into his songs.
It's an art.
And he meets the love of his life. He meets Lori Allen.
I was alone in my life with little to live for, trying my hand at art, thinking that maybe I could save myself. But in my desperation, all my hope would fly away until there was nothing left of me, nothing left to say. And in this nightmare, there was a dream of a girl so beautiful beyond compare, the girl of my dreams. So wonderful, so beautiful. And I had her boots. This was so long ago in my idealistic dream of so many songs. Lori. Yeah. she inspired 1,000 songs. And then I knew I was an artist.
He wrote a lot of sweet songs about Laurie. And I remember something from listening. He wanted to play one for me. I remember, and he doesn't have it. Walking down the road, I'm feeling lonely. But don't be sad, be glad. You're just one step closer to the girl you're going to meet.
He starts following her around with a tape recorder and his little Super 8, following her around and making movies and tape recording her and begging Laurie to say, "I love you, Dan," into the tape, which she eventually does.
Did you say, "I love you, Danny"? You want me to? I love you, Danny.
She has no idea. He's massively obsessed with her.
As soon as she spoke to me, you know, she was so nice, you know, and I was just completely madly in love. And I didn't know it, but she already had a boyfriend. At this time, Pete Arner went to mortician school in Florida. And so he, like, left mortician school and came back. After she got married, a friend of mine's grandfather died, and the funeral was at Arner's funeral home. She was there hanging coats. And as soon as I walked in, I said, "Hi, how are you?" And I shook her hand. And I looked behind her, and there was an empty casket. And I just thought, well, I'm just going to crawl in there.
This is the kind of love he needed to have. He needed to have a love that he couldn't really successfully connect up with. He had to have that thing to chase. He could never have a thing he could catch. So when she married someone else, it was even better. Because then he could really pine. You know, she was gone. And it's just God's little joke that it happens to be an undertaker. So he really liked that event, even though it causes him great pain.
Well, when Dan got depressed, he took to playing the piano, but I didn't understand the depression.
Why, sure, it's a cute little bugger. About yay big, a little warp from the rain. She said, "Well then, sir, this must be your brain." I said, "Thank you, ma'am, I'm always losing that dang thing. I had lost my mind."
We felt that it was wasting time to keep him in college, because he was never going to graduate the way he was going. So we took him out of college and sent him to Houston to live with his brother.
Mom and Dad were trying to get him on the right track, and in all of our minds that meant a productive life, a well-rounded life, not a self-absorbed life. A job is part of that, and in an effort to help, I said, "Let Dan come down for the summer, work at Astro World, and maybe this will get him on his feet or something." When he found out that he had to go to Texas and he would be without his piano, that put a wrench in his plans. So he got a hold of this organ and he takes it into my garage and he turned my weight bench into a recording studio.
"How you doing, Dave? How's it going?" "I'm working on the album now, the new release, Yip, Jump Music. I sound like some kind of MTV person, don't I? I brought out the Ford organ, I just set it up. I thought I'd play one of the songs I played on the album, so turn on the chord organ here."
I knew he was recording, I could hear him singing, but I had no perception that he was, you know, in his mind making this masterpiece. I wanted to help Dan, and I thought I was giving great prophetic advice. I said, Dan, you know, someday you're going to be really good at something and very successful, but it's not going to be your art, and it's not going to be your music. We had to say, look, Dan, you can't stay up all night. You're going to have to go to bed at some kind of decent hour and kind of live life with the rest of us.
My brother has given me the eviction notice of September 1st, I believe, and I'm hoping this will work out because it's hard, you know, making it on your own and getting started, and especially when they're being so rude to you and treating you as if, you know, you're a bum and everything.
Margie kind of stepped in and said that she could, you know, see what she could do to help him, and we packed him up, and off he went into the distance.
I thought, well, you know, he needs a place to go, and I'm his sister, and he can come and stay here. So he came to live with me in my duplex. Now, I didn't have extra furniture for him. We got him a mattress that was just on the floor, but he seemed to thrive in this atmosphere because he was allowed to make a mess.
I grabbed this album, England's Ambassador of Jazz, Johnny Dankworth and his orchestra, and saw a song called Desperate Dan, so I put it on. And as soon as I heard it, I immediately began to identify with it.
I thought everything was fine. Then one day I came home and he wasn't there, which I wasn't too worried because we didn't tell each other everywhere we were going, but when he wasn't there in the morning when I got up, and he hadn't come home all night, that was not typical.
He made a decision to buy a moped, and he disappeared on the moped, right, Bill?
Yes.
And he joined a carnival and went with him. We weren't able to contact him. It's the saddest time in my life not to know where your son is, and he might be needing help.
Don't let the sun go down on your grievous.
The carnival, this little girl at the carnival, her name was Trisha. She's a carnival girl. She's grown up with the carnival. She's about 3 years old. All the time she'd come into the corn dog stand while we were open, and it was slow, you know, and we'd pretend like it was a spaceship, you know. I'd bang on this untuned guitar, and then she started singing this little song, Pizza Hut, Pizza Hut, Merry-Go-Round.
Yeah, I do miss home. I'm down here, and I'm okay. Because wherever I am, I got music in my heart.
During that time, I had a rock inside my chest. I thought he might be in a shallow grave someplace. He left first part of April. I think it was Father's Day when he called and let us know where he was.
Cut calls from Daniel Johnston, please.
Skinny motorcycle of my heart. Many girls have taken you for a ride.
Ended up in Austin is so incredible that it really sounds like an urban legend. When the carnival came to Austin, he was going to the bathroom in the porta potty, and someone was upset about how long he was taking, and they were banging on the door. And so when he came out, it turned out it was like a really big, tough carny guy, and he just hauled off and like socked him and really, really hurt him bad. And Daniel didn't know what to do. He just started looking for a Church of Christ, and he wandered until he saw the University Church of Christ. And he went in and he just asked them to help him. And they ended up taking him, you know, to the doctor and everything, and leasing him an apartment.
The carnival pulled out, leaving me a dizzy and confused individual. I had really been knocked in the head hard, whereas standing there with my broken moped at the wrestling stadium, I still didn't know if I had a place to stay or not. I found myself downtown in Austin with the tall buildings. The retired comedian assured me that my skull would be better after I got plenty of rest,
He had heard the band I was in, which is Glass Eye, and we were just getting popular locally. And he saw a poster for our show, and he decided that this was a really magical sign that he really needed to go to it. And he came to the show, and he gave me a copy of his cassette. So the next time we played, he came over to me, and he was so excited. You could tell he was, like, screwing up his nerve, like, getting ready to, like, ask me what I thought of his music. And he came over, and he goes, "What'd you think?" And I looked at him, and I just couldn't really let him know how much of an asshole I really was, that I hadn't even listened to his music, his most important thing in his life. And I said, "It was great. I loved it. You can totally open for us." And so I went home and I listened to it and I was blown away at its incredible genius.
I really don't know why I'm staying here. Oh, 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 oh. I am walking the cat.
I met Daniel Johnston in kind of the classic Daniel Johnston way. It was a Saturday. I was working at the Boston Chronicle. I was alone in the office. And I was sitting there writing, and I heard somebody at the door. Not a knock, but somebody, like, shuffling at the door. Finally, I went over, and I opened the door, and there, Daniel was standing there. And he was a skinny little kid who looked fairly demented, and he had a tape. And he said, "I just wanted to give you my tape." So I said, "Great, you know, I'll give it to a music person. If they like it, maybe we'll review it, but I'm not promising you anything." And Daniel goes, "Well, you know, I wasn't really giving you that to review. I just wanted you to listen to it. I'm not trying to get a review or anything." So Daniel goes away, and I put it on the tape player. And it just blew my mind. I mean, it was one of those where I got it right away.
Get attached to a rolling stone and you're liable to get crushed. You're better off to sit at home and watch the toilet flush.
And so then he gives you, "Hi, how are you?" And you have chump music. It's like, you know, imagine meeting, you know, Bob Dylan, and he gives you his first six albums and saying, "Oh, here's some stuff I'm working on." So it's this body of music where you're suddenly hearing 20 amazing songs, and they're out of nowhere from this weird little guy. I played it for a lot of music writers and some musicians, and he was giving it to other musicians, and gradually, over like a period of weeks, people began to talk a lot about who this crazy kid was, Daniel Johnston, and this really weird music.
The picture gets all blurred. I see shadows dancing on my wall, thoughts scatter like birds.
Daniel, of course, loves the Beatles, worships them. And I can see that Hi, How Are You could be like Meet the Beatles. Come grab this and start the new Daniel Johnston mania. And in his head, of course, it was there. He was the Beatles. And it was from deep inside here. "Hi, how are you? I'm Daniel Johnston, and this is what scares me, and this is what I love, and this is what terrifies me." You just hear that, and your mind will turn around to his. You start off hearing this noise. Then eventually, you hear the Beatles. You hear the whole symphony. He actually didn't just record a tape and mass produce it. He sometimes couldn't duplicate, so he had to sing the entire tape from beginning to end to hand you a copy. Go back home, start again, song by song, fill up the tape, hand another person a copy. Fill it up, go, and finally write another album. Start the whole process over again.
As far as I know, his very first, like, public show that he did was done opening for Glass Eye. And he was so nervous. He literally was vibrating. And he also had recently decided, since coming to Austin, that he wasn't going to play piano anymore, something he does rather well. He decided that he was going to play guitar, like all the Austin guitar slingers, and he really couldn't play. That was scary for him, too.
All of a sudden, it quieted down, like it was church or something. Daniel comes on stage, and it was very unusual, because anyone playing their first show, it's like you're lucky to get anyone to pay attention, but everyone was just absolutely silent, and he looked so nervous, looked like he was going to vomit the whole time.
Time is a matter of fact, and it's gone, and it'll never come back, and mine is wasted all the time. Tears, stupid tears, bring me down.
So when you saw him perform, I mean, especially in the early days when he did, you know, the two or three song sets, sometimes they were god-awful, and sometimes they were unbelievably brilliant. I mean, sometimes he just nailed it. I mean, sometimes it was so abstract. I mean, and some of it was what wasn't there. Sometimes there was too much not there.
Tie my brain into a knot. Those tears, stupid tears, bring me down.
People in the audience tended to be like, "What? Is this a joke? Is this guy supposed to be cool?" And they would be looking around at each other like, "How am I supposed to react?" Because He was so raw and so real in a lot of ways that people couldn't take it.
Ask me a question. Where do you work?
I work at McDonald's, and this is my new album, Hi, How Are You?
Yeah?
And it's an old album, but if you get a chance, please listen to it.
Okay, thanks.
He's got a full shift at McDonald's, and as close as I can tell, he can't do anything. He can't cook, he doesn't clean very well.
As in a lot of places, you know, they'll give him work, but then he migrates to the job with the least skill, which was cleaning tables.
It was amazing that he could keep his job, because everybody was always coming in there wanting to, hey, Daniel, and you know, they don't take well to that at fast food joints. But he was employed there for a long time, and you knew you could find him there, just in his little hat and his little shirt there, cleaning up other people's spills and stuff.
When I went to visit him at McDonald's, I think it was probably the first time I recognized that he was spacing out, you know, that there was a disconnection from reality or something going on.
Kick sick now.
The elated phase of manic depressive psychosis is essentially the opposite of the depressed one. The patient describes his mood as top-notch happy, and he says, I never felt better in my life. When interfered with, he shows undue irritability and anger. He is overactive and overtalkative. His ideas come so rapidly that he jumps from one topic to the other. Distractibility is a common feature. Many maniacs talk in rhyme where they pun for hours on end. Grandiose delusions are often expressed. Judgment is so poor that the maniac may go on spending sprees, pass bad checks, or drink alcohol to excess. Sexual desire is increased, which fact, coupled with poor judgment, may lead to escapades and the contraction of a venereal disease or illegitimate pregnancies. The patient with bizarre manifestations may decorate himself with medals, buttons, feathers, pins, or rags. He may be noisy and shout. He may injure himself, but if he does, he pays no attention to the injury. Sleep is poor and of no definite pattern, and he's usually too busy to bother with eating. These factors in the overactivity lead to a loss of weight. In extreme cases of manic excitement, the patient may be so active and excitable as to talk incoherently and to be disoriented. This is a danger of physical exhaustion. Hallucinations support the grandiose delusions. Well, there you have it. I'm a manic depressive with grand delusions.
1985 was just an enormous year for Austin music. It was like everything was about to break, and again, Daniel just came in right at that time. MTV started sniffing around, and they brought in Peter Zaremba and the show. They had The Cutting Edge. They lined up all these bands, and they had a big old barbecue, and Daniel showed up there with his tapes.
This is Daniel Johnson, local man about town, musician. Everyone knows who he is, but say hi to everyone.
My name is Daniel Johnson. This is the name of my tape, and it's Hi, How Are You? And I was having a nervous breakdown when I recorded it.
He wasn't scheduled to be on the show. They had already listened to tapes and talked to the people at the Chronicle and the music critics, and they decided who was going to be on this special and everything. But Daniel was unstoppable at that point. He was so full of confidence. He always presented himself like, I am a very incredible, extraordinary human being, and you're going to be really happy you listened to this.
How you doing? We're having a casual conversation on national TV.
Daniel is on MTV. Out of nowhere, from my point of view, he's on MTV, and I actually do get to see it, and he says to me,
this is the David Thornberry from Daniel Johnston, and Dave, here I am on MTV holding up my tape, Hi, How Are You? And they're recording me tonight, I'm on MTV. Remember when we used to watch MTV back home? Look, I'm on MTV, David.
And that was his dream. I mean, literally, that's what he wanted to do, was be on MTV.
I did wrong. My hopes lay shattered like a mirror on the floor. I see myself and I look really scattered. But I live my broken dream.
He always knew where to be at any given moment, and while this was being filmed, it was like MTV, you know, he knew MTV is here in town. And by far, he became one of the most memorable things in the show, and he basically just scammed his way into it.
The wildest summer that I ever knew. I had a flat tire down memory lane, but I came back after 5 months and a half, and now I'm just trying to explain. And now I'm here, and here I stand with a sweet angel holding my hand. I live my broken dreams.
I'm gonna go for it. I really am. It's really happening. It's really happened. I really was on MTV. I really am going, you know?
Instantly, McDonald's expands his hours to like 20 or 30 hours a week. They give him more shifts, not because he's doing anything, but because he's become a star, and whoever the manager is thinks this is entertaining. And then the other weird thing that begins happening is there's all this interest in Daniel. So you hear record companies are calling McDonald's, because that's the only way you can call Daniel. Daniel doesn't have a phone. So Spin's calling McDonald's and music magazines, and so you get all these calls. And in the beginning, I think the McDonald's people were really kind of entertained by this, but after a while, when you'd call to talk to Daniel, they were not happy. You know, they had hamburgers to make. And then in 1986, he wins a bunch of awards in the Austin Music Awards. He wins Songwriter of the Year and Best Folk Act, which is very controversial, and of course it goes to Daniel's head in new and different ways.
In a town with a lot of singer-songwriters and a lot of folkies who can play guitar, that might not have gone over too well with some people.
He was fooling through his own personal hell. Dropped his last dime in a wishing well, but he was hoping too close, then he fell. Now he's Casper, the friendly ghost.
In the spring of 1986, I started helping Daniel. The first thing I did was set up his publishing company with Bug Music. I knew his music was great, but I felt like for him to actually make a living, he would be better off if other more well-known artists were to cover his material.
He was always polite to the people who tell him that he was nothing but a lazy bum, but goodbye to them, he had to go. Now he's Casper, the friendly ghost.
I thought that he was almost angelic. And then I got to know him better. And we started being really close friends, and for a little while I was his girlfriend. And because he was very religious, this was a very chaste relationship. But even within the context of that, it was undeniable after maybe 1 or 2 weeks that something was dreadfully wrong with him. Something that wasn't angelic and pure and naive and innocent and beautiful. I realized I can't let him keep on thinking that I'm his girlfriend, because his parents came to visit him and he introduced me as his fiance. I realized that I was going to have to say, Daniel, we're not going out anymore. You know, we're just friends. And I essentially spent the entire summer reminding him. We broke up.
Kathy McCarthy said she was going to marry me, and then she didn't. I mean, she said she was going to marry me, and then she said she didn't want to marry me. She didn't want to go with me and stuff, you know what I mean? I had a pretty hard time, you know, because, I mean, everything I was thinking was going the other way.
Are you feeling?
Man, this is so wild.
Daniel began hanging out with his manager, Randy Kemper, and was smoking a lot of marijuana, and he would not perform live. Everybody was bugging him to play live, but he just didn't want to. There were some changes in his behavior, and we didn't really quite know what was going on with him.
You know, when you do stuff like that, you throw me off, Daniel.
I always kind of imagined Daniel performing like Elton John, with costume changes and rockettes and a big grand piano, just the kind of show that's just ridiculous, almost like Andy Kaufman-esque kind of thing. But unfortunately, he had his mental breakdown.
So he goes to a Butthole Surfer show, and somebody there gives him a hit of acid. And the trip really begins to change everything. Again, one of the classic scenarios of Daniel's life is whenever anything starts getting really good, you know something really ugly is going to happen.
The night in question is September 11th, 1986, in which Daniel had a bad experience. And I guess he was under the influence of some sort of psychoactive substance.
You know, I remember a little bit about seeing Daniel that night. I remember him being sort of difficult to deal with, and then we had our thing going on, and everybody started saying, Daniel's freaked out, Daniel's freaked out, Daniel's freaked out.
I'm coming back to tell you, man. I'm serious, like Billy Graham. Nothing like Billy Graham, or nothing like that, or nothing like nobody you ever heard tell about nothing. But I'm coming back, and I'm telling you, there's a supernatural world. There's a supernatural world. And Gibby, yeah, Gibby knows about it.
So did you give him the acid that night?
No, I didn't give him any LSD. I think at that point it was pretty much known that he was not necessarily an unstable character, but slightly unstable of character. So that's the kind of person you really wouldn't want to engage in the LSD experience.
Are you Daniel Johnston?
I used to be Daniel Johnston.
Who are you now?
I don't know.
In December of 1986, Daniel was taking a lot of acid and was just not himself. Was very, very delusional, and there was one violent incident with his manager in which he attacked him and put him in the hospital with a concussion.
I saw that pipe there, man. I just picked it up and whammed him one. Three times I whammed him.
Dan was imagining all kinds of things, and he thought of himself as God's man to straighten things up, so it caused a lot of trouble.
All the family met together for Christmas. Mom and Dad couldn't come that year, and so we had decided, since all of the siblings were in Texas, that we would get together and have Christmas.
So we're all making these Christmas ornaments, and his Christmas ornament is this black number 9. We asked him, said, Dan, that's not an appropriate Christmas symbol. What does that mean? And why are you doing black? It's not going to look good hanging on the tree.
I remember staring at him while we were talking and saying, it doesn't even look like Dan. His face doesn't look like Dan to me. He was in some kind of manic state. We get up for a family portrait, and he would hang a Beatles album on a Christmas tree. Well, I went to take it down off the tree, and he came for me, and he had super strength. And in just a very brief struggle, he broke my rib.
So they were rolling around on the floor, and it was just not the way our Christmas gatherings usually are. He was talking in different voices and was accusing us of teaching the children Satanist practice. And that whole night, we didn't want to go to sleep because he believed we were Satanists. He might try to do something to harm us if he's the hero of good or something.
He decided to make a dash to go up to the attic space where the kids were playing. And at that point, Sally went to the phone and called the police.
We had to call for some assistance and remove him from the house. And my husband took him to the bus station and then stayed and watched to make sure he got on it so that we would all feel safe.
I remember going upstairs with Margie and laying down on the bed, and we just both wept like he was dead, you know, because we didn't know who he was.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history, yeah.
I was looking through the Bible, and it said that Daniel was a dreamer and an interpreter of visions. I see a lot of these things come to me as sort of a vision. It's just like something that appears to me like in a really wild way, strangely and magically.
I'm lying in bed. I have pneumonia, and the phone rings. And I mean, I have like 103 temperature, and the phone rings, and somebody says, do you know Daniel Johnston? I go, yeah, Daniel and I are friends. He goes, well, I think maybe you should come here. I go, well, I really don't think I should. I'm sick. And so, no, I really, really think you should come here.
I get to campus. I have 103 degrees temperature. It's 1986 and it's Christmas, so there's nothing there. There's no cars, there's no people. This campus is completely empty. It's weird, it's eerie, it's quiet. These people I don't know are leading me down, and we start walking down to go towards the river. And we look over, and there's the water, and there standing in the middle of the water is Daniel. And he's standing in the water, he's about knee deep, splashing the water, and he's looking at us. His eyes are like white. At one point he looks up and he starts singing, running water, running water. And then he's preaching, and he's talking about baptism, and he's talking about evil. He's really whack. We're trying to talk him into coming onto the shore. It's going on and on and on, and it's getting real weird. All of a sudden, we look over there, A couple police cars have pulled up.
They forced me out. They came. People were afraid. They were afraid to come after me while they didn't want me splashing with water. What was I doing down there? What was going on? I knew exactly what was going on. I wanted to take my life only a few nights before. I hit my best friend over the head with a lead pipe. I thought there was nowhere to go. I thought the military takeover was going to happen over Christmas time, but it didn't. You know what I mean? I knew, I saw. I went inside building UT. I saw the things, the programming, the confusion, the Coke, Coca-Cola, Snickers, all the candy and everything being used as a drug, the confusion, the mind control, spiritualism, cultural upheaval, flip. Man, yes, it's really happening. They're really doing it, man. I'm talking, if you don't know about it, I'm talking like Nazi Germany.
All great artists are crazy, but there's a difference between the abstract great artist being crazy and this person doing damage to you or to himself, and how involved do you want to be? We'd spent our whole lives, we were those kind of people who loved the notion of the crazy artist, you know, Van Gogh cutting off his ear, and we'd read those books and we, you know, collected the art and we'd seen the movies, and we really loved the crazy people because they were the pure people. You know, they didn't have any commercial sense. And yet he was a real sick person. And it was really, what are we going to do? And so, I mean, we do the most pedestrian thing possible, we commit him. And you actually felt, I mean, a certain amount of guilt. I mean, it was like, if I was around Van Gogh, and, you know, I've always had contempt for those people who didn't understand genius, and here I am, given my shot, and what I'm saying is, please, put him in the hospital, because we don't want to have to deal with him, we don't know what to do.
When I went to see him in the hospital, they wanted to know what my relationship with Daniel was, and I had been working informally as his publicist, but I needed to tell them something a little better than that, and I assumed that Randy Kemper, after having been beat over the head with a lead pipe, did not want to continue managing Daniel, so I said I was his manager. I helped get Daniel out of the hospital because I didn't fully understand why he was there. All I knew was he needed to get out of there, and as soon as I did get him out, I began hearing from other people asking me why did I do that. But it seemed like he was doing well enough. He was back in his home, and it seemed like everything was okay, although it was very borderline.
It's like true, it's science fiction, and it's the new supernatural age. You know, it spoke of in Revelations, and number 9, the Beatles song, number 9.
He was obsessed with the devil and Satan.
Do not get that number, 666. Do not get 666 imprinted on your hand.
I had never really heard him talk about the devil before, and he became so obsessed that it was all he could talk about.
You must not give in to the devil, ladies and gentlemen. The world in confusion. Ladies and gentlemen, somebody's manufacturing these. They're spreading those around. They might be mounting them up around. Evil, ladies and gentlemen. Evil.
Over the next few days, he began to throw literally everything he owned away. He threw all his drawings away. He threw master tapes away. And he was down to just 3 or 4 possessions. The last time I went to his apartment, he still had his tape deck. He still had his guitar and maybe 1 or 2 other things. And as soon as I saw this, my immediate fear was that he's going to kill himself.
Better to die, ladies and gentlemen, and live forever. And that is what I intend to do.
I went home that night, not knowing what to do.
The world is turning to hell.
I did not know very much about his relationship with his family, but I figured they need to know this. And I called his father that night, and he was in Austin within 24 hours.
He was thin as a rail and losing weight and all kinds of things. And his depression finally caught up with him.
Evil.
Because he was losing it.
Number 9.
When Daniel's father took him back to West Virginia, Daniel announced his retirement and instantly became a living legend in Austin. He pretty much spent the entire year of 1987 on medication.
I've never been on any medication.
You're lucky.
What does it feel like?
Groggy.
You wake up late?
A little tired. Oh, yeah. I lay in bed, just can't get the guts to get up.
Haldol's a control drug, and at times he was a vegetable.
And we finally talked to the psychiatrist, and she said she would have a psychiatrist examine him.
He'll wire your brain up and make sure you got what your brain activity is and check if there's any brain damage or anything, and he checked out okay. But we took him to the University of Pittsburgh.
Psychiatric Institute.
And had 7 people interview him for a whole day.
The reason...
He said he's on the wrong medicine.
Yeah.
Every medicine he reacted different to. And we kept trying. We tried and tried different ones.
Is it a lot harder to write songs now?
Yes, because I'm all dried up. I couldn't write a song if I tried. Do-do-do. I couldn't write a song if I tried. Do-do-do. Something inside has gone up and died, and I couldn't write a song if I tried. Do-do-do.
He literally spent the entire year in bed. He calls it his lost year. During this period, I was continuing to work on building his relationships with bands like Sonic Youth and Jad Fair, half Japanese. I had become friends with Steve Shelley of Sonic Youth. Steve turned a lot of people on to Daniel's music. And as Daniel finally started to show some improvement, Steve invited him to New York City to check out a recording studio and just basically to hang out a little bit, get to know each other and have some fun.
We're on our way to the studio.
One day he's scheduled to do some recording at Noise New York with us, Steve and Lee from Sonic Youth, and he's just as happy as can be, joking around, talking about making movies. He says he's going to make a movie someday and all he has to do is act naturally.
All I got to do is act naturally. I'm going to play this guy who has a damn soul. He's trying to warn the rest of the world. It was my fate to become famous and also to be damned.
He's there to become famous. That is his one and only goal in his mind.
How's New York been for the last 2 days?
It's the greatest city on the earth.
This is day number 3 for you here.
Yeah, it's happening for sure. If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere, right?
That's what they say.
There were 2 primary goals of this trip. One was to meet Kramer and check out the Noise New York recording studio with the possibility of recording for Shimmy Disc. And the other was to do some recording with Mo Tucker, the drummer for the Velvet Underground. This session was put together by Jad Fair. And this would allow Daniel to meet Jad for the first time. As Daniel's manager, I'm in touch with Steve Shelley on a nightly basis, and all of a sudden one night I get a call that Daniel has been arrested that day. It seems that they decided to take him to the Statue of Liberty. And while Daniel was touring the Statue of Liberty, like any tourist would want to, he apparently was drawing graffiti inside the stairwell. Christian fish, hundreds of them, from what I understand. I guess it's the anti-Satan symbol.
This is a national monument.
Yes, sir.
And we can arrest you right now. You can either A, pay a fine of $75, come back here and clean up every last one of those fish that you did.
Yes, sir.
Or B, you'll have to appear before a federal district court judge.
Yes.
I can't believe you did that. I really can't.
A couple days after that, there's a bizarre gig at Pierre Platter's. I say bizarre because he's proselytizing the audience, trying to force his religious beliefs on the audience, basically.
Jesus Christ is number 7. Satan is number 6. Number 8 is eternal death. And number 9 is the human number. Remember these things and don't listen to the lies that people will tell you. Number 7 is Jesus Christ.
When Daniel performed at Pierre Platter's, it was like the cream of the crop of the New York underground music scene. During the song Funeral Home, he actually gets the audience to sing along with him. So you've got everybody singing along about going to the funeral home and dying.
Funeral and I'm never coming back. Sing along with us, will you? Funeral home.
More and more fanatically religious as the show went on. He has a bit of a breakdown, starts crying at one point, and is just obviously right on the edge. And it was my belief and the belief of others around him that things are getting a little bit out of control.
You'll be called to meet your God, careless soul. Oh, heed the warning for your life.
will soon be gone.
The concert made everyone feel very awkward. And after the show, walking back to Steve's place, Daniel and Steve had a bit of a falling out.
You call my parents, man, and you're in for it. Hear me?
Daniel, go ahead. Hit me. Kill me.
The devil has you, buddy.
Let go of me.
You're not going to call my parents.
Every second you're making things worse.
You want to ruin it all for me, have them put me in a loony bin. Is that what you want? That's what they want? Is that what you want for me? They'll take me to a mental hospital, Steve.
He told Kramer that if he can't get anywhere, he's going to sleep in my hallway.
Yeah, but that's just an idle threat.
What was the next train to...
I can't imagine him staying in the bus station and actually getting on the bus all by himself.
I know the members of Sonic Youth were looking all over for Daniel. He had been spotted in various places, and they just felt this responsibility to his parents to get him home.
Now keep an eye peeled for Daniel. He might just be... If you see a wandering guy in white...
Steve didn't really want to deal with it, so Lee and Thurston were driving around. They finally spotted him in a hotel parking lot, I believe, in Jersey.
There he is.
Really?
Yeah, he's walking over here.
Let's go get him.
Well, Steve is totally
pissed. He's freaked out.
Yeah, he's freaked out. He
was going to call my parents. My parents put me in a mental home.
The best thing to do at this point, you have a bus ticket. I think you should
use it. I'm not going home. I'm on a mission from God, and I have two more weeks to spend in this town.
The situation here for you now is not the best that it could be. And we really don't know what to do. I mean, you're a long way from home. And we don't...
I called my manager. I started to talk to him about it. And I was going I was going to warn him not to say anything to my parents. I was going to say, if you say anything to my parents, I'm going to fire you. And I was saying, this is a warning and this is a threat. And he says, I don't want to hear any of your damn threats. And he hung up on me, my manager. Now, don't you see the devil? The devil, Satan, is trying to stop me from staying in this town. Don't you see how clear that is?
He just would not go home and was determined to stay in New York. He ended up in the Bowery in a men's shelter where he was assaulted once or twice, lost some possessions.
I got somebody watching my suitcase in here.
At this point, Daniel is homeless and hungry and having the time of his life while everybody else is completely freaked out. His parents, myself, his hosts. We don't know what to do, whereas Daniel doesn't even realize there's a problem. Finally, a couple of friends made arrangements to take him to the bus station, buy him a ticket to go back home. They thought they saw him getting on the bus. The next thing they know, 2 days later, Daniel is spotted back in New York City. He spent some time in Bellevue a day or two, was released due to a clerical error, and actually opened for Firehose at CBGB's that night.
In my head there is a negative Superman. In my head, two worlds collide.
After the CBGB's gig, he did his two songs and left. All anybody could think of was we got to get him home before he either kills somebody or gets killed. His goal in New York was to become famous, and I think he accomplished his goal by the time he left. When Daniel returned home from New York, he was hospitalized almost immediately and let out way too soon, in my opinion.
It just seems like I'm so worried about you. I'm just so... concerned.
Well, you need to take it easy and read the scriptures and try to...
I do, Dan.
Try to comfort yourself.
I do. But you got into a lot of trouble, and I feel you have compulsive behavior yet that could get you into more trouble.
I'm doing much better, and it's very healthy for me getting back involved in music. I call you every day.
Just a few weeks later, he traveled to Maryland to record with Jad Fair.
Putting Jad and Daniel together was, I mean, I think they're both geniuses. So if you put them together, you know, I don't see how that could miss. I think you get like two giants together, and it's gigantic.
If I'd only known, I could have said something sooner. But I didn't, so I did. Now it's done. The last thing I'd do was the first thing you did. What we once had is all gone.
Had a white t-shirt on, or white painter pants maybe, or something.
He was dressed all in white.
All white.
During that time period, he thought it would be the Christian thing to do, to dress in white.
Yeah.
David invited Daniel and me to his home to have dinner. Back then, the movie My Dinner with Andre was very popular. And we decided, well, let's have
my dinner with Daniel and film that, and we'll just be talking during dinner time.
So I went to college right across the riverfront where the funeral home is, and there was this girl there, and as soon as I saw her, you know, I swear to God, it looked like she was glowing, you know.
Daniel wanted to direct.
Stand right there. He's the cameraman. And you sit in the chair. You
know, he had very specific ideas for everything.
You know, he'd figure out shots, he'd change angles. I mean, at the beginning of the evening, it was a film I had in mind. Very soon, it became a, you know, somebody else's film.
Film the chair, okay?
The highlight, probably, though, was when Daniel started playing the songs. I mean, at one point, when he started weeping, you know, this is, you know, where are you going to see a performance like that? Dropped him off at the bus station. I don't think anything really seemed strange. I don't think he seemed different from how he had been all week long.
He had a ticket to go to his parents' home in Chester, West Virginia, which is only about a five-hour bus ride, and we thought he'd be fine.
Great music and art came out of this week, but unfortunately he went off his meds again and had problems when he left. Took a bus back to West Virginia, got off a little too soon, and was completely delusional, thought that everybody was possessed by Satan. It was very early in the morning, maybe 6, 7 in the morning. Making noise in the street, an elderly woman came to her window, asked him to be quiet, and that set off another major incident.
And the next thing she knew, he was coming up the stairs in the apartment building and pounding on the door. And whatever he was saying and whatever his demeanor was enough to terrify her such that she felt like the only thing she could do is jump out of the second story window, and of course she broke both her ankles. And she was an elderly woman. From church.
The law pretty well takes over when he gets into trouble. The law stepped in and took Dan away from us.
Quite busy during this time writing me audio letters with all sorts of instructions.
Earth to Jeff Tartikoff, 10-4, come 3. This is a message from Daniel Dale Johnston, here with a few ideas I'd like to do. First of all, I wish that the Beatles would reunite and back me up as a band.
He continued to want me to get in touch with people like Yoko Ono, but he also had some additional ideas. He wanted to be a spokesperson for Mountain Dew.
This is Daniel Johnston speaking. From a mental hospital. They tell me I'm crazy here because I love the Mountain Dew so much. I can't get enough of the Mountain Dew. I was sinking deep in sin, far from Mountain Dew.
I had problems out within, nothing that I could do. But the Mountain Dew came to me, and I drank it all up. Now I'm happy as can be, oh Mountain Dew. We drink Mountain Dew, we drink Mountain Dew. We have nothing better to do but drink Mountain Dew. We drink Mountain Dew, we drink Mountain Dew. No thing better to do than to drink Mountain Dew. Yahoo! Mountain Dew! It's the new sensation, the best, the greatest, the most fantastic, the most sensational soda pop in the cosmic universe, Mountain Dew! Out come the demons. Demons, 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 drink the Mountain Dew.
I sent that off to the Pepsi Corporation, but unfortunately never got a response.
So it's 1990. We hear Daniel's better. We hear he's gotten put on a lot of weight, but we hear he's doing his meds. He's under control. So we invite him to play the Austin Music Awards show and to come and play South by Southwest. And everybody's very excited about this. Now his rep has really, really grown. Tartikoff has really been getting those tapes out there. Tartikoff's really working it. Daniel sends me a comic about how Daniel's coming back to Austin to play the Music Awards, how he's going to get laid, how all the girls should be ready for him. And the last page is this whole thing about the devil being really excited that Daniel's coming back to Austin because of all the mayhem he could cause. Whenever Daniel was going to perform, starting around now, he went off his meds for a couple of weeks before the performance because he knew the performance would be better the crazier he was. The more real he was, the better the performance would be. But nobody really knew this at the time.
I took my lucky break and broke it.
Try it again, man. It's a professional, yes. Performer. I haven't performed, you know, for 2 years. So. I'm barely doing it now.
He flew to town with his dad, did 2 in-store appearances at record stores. Hundreds and hundreds of people turned out. People were coming up for autographs, and he would give them so much more than just an autograph. He would take a full sheet of paper and draw a frog, an entire scene. This was really the highlight of my career up until that point, because I was able to see an audience, a large audience, respond to Daniel. Palmer Auditorium had 3,000 people there that night. Daniel was scheduled to play about a 15-minute set, but he's not a very good judge of time, so he walked off the stage after 3 songs.
Daniel.
Dad. Yeah? Want to do another, Dan? You want me to do another song?
Want to go back?
Okay.
And when he finally came out, it was as if the Rolling Stones had come back on stage. During the song, Do You Love Me, the chorus goes, Do You Love Me Now? And you could hear girls in the audience screaming, Yes! It was Daniel Mania. The audience is stomping and screaming. You could feel the entire floor shaking.
Thank you.
He was the hit of that show. He got standing ovations. Nobody else did. But he was feeling funny. Right after his last performance, we left. We passed up interviews, and we left. It shouldn't have happened, but Dan was secretly ducking his medicine. I was giving it to him, but he was chucking it.
It said in the paper that Dan thought he was Captain America.
Captain America.
On the flight.
No, he thought he was Casper. He was reading a Casper comic book. There was a picture on the front of the book of Casper in a parachute. And Dan decided, let's bail out. Let's jump out. I said, no, we can't do that. We don't have any parachutes. So his mind was gone. Eventually, he took the key out, turned the engine off, threw the key out the window.
How did you recover the flight?
Well, he grabbed the controls, took the plane away from me. He's stronger than me. We were kind of going straight up and then straight down. But he kind of let go in time for me to get it out of the spin. Nothing down there but trees. But I had training on ditching in trees, so I didn't stall it. I flew it into the trees between two big ones. And we got out safe. But the plane was a total loss. The family came and got us. Got me. We put him in the hospital and left him there for 5 months.
There's Dan. He's had a good time because he thought that was great. He's coming down in a spin. He was all mixed up. He felt like he did something good and he wanted us to be proud of him. There's Dan being rolled into the emergency room. They passed a Church of Christ, and to Bill and Dick's amazement, this sign was on the Church of Christ bulletin board out front. God promises a safe landing, but not a calm voyage.
Justice moved to Waller, Texas in late 1991, and I believe Daniel began having some problems fairly immediately and ended up back in the Austin State Hospital. During this time, his career continued to reach for the stars. Bands were covering his songs left and right. Kurt Cobain of the band Nirvana wore his t-shirt on MTV at the MTV Music Awards show, which was seen by millions of people. He had had the shirt for a few months. Apparently, a writer that I had given the shirt to, a guy named Everett True, had given it to Kurt. And next thing you know, he's wearing it not only on national TV, but everywhere he goes. And over the next several months, every single photo shot he did, he was wearing this shirt. And just a tremendous amount of publicity came Daniel's way due to this. Suddenly, everybody knew who Daniel was. It was just incredible that a t-shirt could fuel this kind of a frenzy. The t-shirt had many, many thousands of fans that wanted to know more about the t-shirt and wanted to hear the t-shirt and see the t-shirt and get to know the t-shirt. Meanwhile, Daniel's in a hospital and has no idea who Nirvana even is. And within a matter of days, I get a call from a guy named Terry Tolkien, who's a A&R executive for Elektra Records. And we got into a long conversation that ended with him saying, well, I'd really like to sign Daniel. Terry and I met for a couple days, hung out, discussed everything that needed to be discussed, and then it was time to take him over to the hospital and meet with Daniel. And we sat in the waiting room, Daniel came out, and we had a business meeting for about 30, 45 minutes, and it went as well as a meeting can possibly go in a mental institution between a vice president of a record label and a patient. We were trying to structure a contract that took his delicate situation into consideration. It's not every day that a major label signs somebody who's in a mental institution. They were looking out for Daniel's best interest. There was a clause in there about his mental health, about providing a doctor, about how he would never have to tour, about how he could never be dropped for failure to promote a record. And they looked at it as a long-term project. It wouldn't be just one record, it would be a career. It was probably the most one-sided contract in the favor of artists' rights that had ever been drawn up until that time. We obviously had to get Daniel well, get him out of the hospital. And over the next few months, Daniel continued to improve, but it was very slow. We bided our time, did what we could for him, and just kept waiting for the day when he would be released. Yves Bouvet of Atlantic Records contacted me around that time, wanting to know what was Daniel's situation. And I told him, well, we're fairly close to signing with Elektra. His boss, Danny Goldberg, who was the head of Atlantic Records, formerly worked with Kurt Cobain as their manager, and he wasn't familiar with Daniel's music, but he certainly knew who the guy in the t-shirt was. And the next thing you know, I've got a bidding war on my hands. Daniel's in a mental hospital, and I've got two major labels trying to outbid each other. Suddenly, we're looking at a $100,000 possibility. Once Daniel was released from the hospital, I was trying to get help for him. I was working with his parents, trying to make doctor's appointments for him. And Daniel thought he was fine. He did not want to see the doctor. And Elektra wanted him to sign this contract, and Daniel was paranoid about that. He was afraid that Elektra was satanic. They had a band on their roster called Metallica. He was concerned that they were going to beat him and kill him. And he could not be convinced that he was safe.
This is Metallica's song about the beast, and all shall receive the mark of the beast who aren't saints or die.
His delusions would just not go away. He was convinced that Elektra was evil and that I was evil. Elektra had to be evil because they were tied to me. And so the deal died, and this was the deal I had been working for 7 years for. This is the deal I had been working for 30-something years for. It was what I had been building towards my whole life.
Jeff Tartikoff is really a lot like Broadway Danny Rose. Have you ever seen that movie? This guy loves his acts.
Never took a lesson.
He lives to make them successful. And that's the way Jeff always was with Daniel. Jeff literally was like that old-time kind of manager you hear about and you read about, and people make movies about this sort of person who lived for the good of his client.
The man would be perfect for your room.
He literally devoted his life 100% to Daniel Johnston. For all the years where nothing was happening, and then right when Daniel was poised to get an international bidding war on his career, he just completely dropped him like a hot potato for absolutely no reason.
I gotta make a few changes.
Like what kind of changes?
Like management.
What do you mean management? Like, what do you mean management?
I was fired so many times over the years and over these months specifically that it's hard to tell which one actually counted. But I continued trying to work things out until I received a call one day from a guy named Tom Gimbel, who informed me that he was Daniel's new manager. I felt like a failure at that time. I felt like I was the biggest failure and loser in the world.
I love that girl so much, I can't get enough of her love, crazy love.
She walks on down the street.
Living with Dan in the same house is something that is not easy to get along with at times. We have kind of worked out a system that works a little bit for us. It's past noon and Dan has been asleep since we got up this morning. We get up about 7 and he's still sleeping. That gives us that half of the day without Dan. And we appreciate that as a relief, because the minute he gets up, he'll want us to make him some tea. He'll want something to eat. He'll want to go, are we going shopping today? Every other day he wants to go shopping. We try to take him somewhere every week. Now we take him to church with us at least once a week. And we take him to the mall or to the local Walmart once a week. And then his friends come to see him and take him to practice. The band that he's working with now will practice once a week.
Yeah, I think you want to do it one more time? Turn the, okay, that's good. Testing! Okay. Imagine a world without rock and roll. There'd be no, wait a minute, I can't hear my vocal.
We moved here from Ohio about 2.5 years ago, and then we were driving down the road one day toward my grandma's house, who lives here, and we saw this guy being attacked by dogs, and I told Bridget, man, this looks like Daniel Johnston. I think this is Daniel Johnston. And she's like, oh, no, that's not Daniel Johnston. So what we did was we stopped anyway, you know, to help the guy out, and Bridget got out of the car, and she kicked the dog right in the face, and it ran off, and then Daniel was like, hey, do you guys play guitar?
He's a man obsessed. He used to be a lover, so now he's a pest. He plays the game, but he fails the test. And now he's a pest, he's a pest. He's a pest.
He said, well, how about I come over sometime? And I said, yeah, are you Daniel Johnston? And he's like, yeah, I'm Daniel Johnston. You know who I am? And I thought, well, this is amazing, man. Daniel Johnston and Waller, I had no idea that he even lived here.
The only way you can get her to look at you is to die. Why don't you die?
We got his number, and we called him up the next week, and he came over to the house, and we recorded 4 songs with him in, like, 1 hour.
He's a man obsessed. He couldn't be a lover, so now he's a pest.
We were wondering why we moved to Waller to begin with. You know, we know why we moved to Waller, you know, because, you know, it was heaven sent.
Oh, he's a pest. Oh, he's a pest. Man of death.
Daniel started listening to the Beach Boys, like, after we played Pet Sounds for him, I think. He said he never heard Pet Sounds before, but we played it for him one night, and he was floored by it. And so he went out and bought, like, every Beach Boys record you could possibly imagine. I don't know if Brian Wilson and Daniel are very much alike. Every time I read something about Daniel in a magazine or something, it mentions Brian Wilson. I honestly think Daniel's far more brilliant than Brian Wilson is. Of course, the Beach Boys music is really far out, but it's not quite Daniel Johnston.
I read the story of Brian Wilson that he wrote himself. And he tells that his father was not a fair manager. Bill is a fair manager, and is not after the money for himself. He's after it for Dan.
Brian Wilson had a lot of the similar characteristics and infirmities that Dan has, and he went through the same stages of development that Dan has gone through. And reading his history, it smacks a whole lot of exactly what's happening to Dan. We're learning from it. We don't want to make the same mistakes. He did well, actually, in the end, and we'd like Dan to do well, too, because he needs to.
You know, one time I asked my dad, when I was about 14, what he feared most in life. He said that when I'm older, my children won't take care of me. It must be pretty terrifying. And I thought, you know, I'd buy my parents that house, and they wouldn't have to worry about the payments on it or anything. I really wish I could do that. Maybe I can someday.
His new songs for the movie.
No, why don't he do his old hit songs for the movie?
Well, it just depends on when he's in the mood. He will.
Yeah, I don't even know my old songs.
That's the thing. He doesn't remember the tune, and he doesn't remember the words.
I had a dream about you. You were the queen of quite a few. And I was there, but you didn't care. I didn't matter somehow. By the time Glass Eye broke up in 1993, Daniel was still in the mental hospital, and he'd been there for a long time, and I rather thought the possibility existed, sad as it was, that he might never produce anything again. And a lot of the music that he had recorded was, to the general populace, unlistenable. And I felt like people would maybe never get him, and he would just be like a flower that bloomed in the desert, you know, and was forgotten. So I thought that I would do some of his songs, some of my favorites, and do them in such a way that they kind of bloomed and became, from, like, say, a ballpoint and notepaper sketch, they kind of came into more of a full-color painting. So I decided to make the record, and it was so fun working with material that was so good. And it's probably the best thing I've ever done. And if I'm remembered for anything ever, it'll be for that record.
After The Fun and Kathy McCarty release, Daniel and I did not talk for 4 years. I went into such a deep depression that I just wanted to have nothing to do with the guy. I really could not even listen to his music, but I still had this fascination with his artwork. I continued to compile my collection, purchasing drawings from other sources.
How's it going?
How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Seen Daniel lately?
Actually, he came by a few months ago. We're almost out of what he brought us.
I'll take what I can get.
The black-white one?
Yeah, not bad at all.
I was occasionally contacted by galleries around the world wanting to show his art, and if it sounded like a good thing, I would help them out. We had shows in Berlin, Eindhoven, Paris, Barcelona, London, Manchester, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. There were really more than I could count during these 4 years that Daniel and I were not even talking. He was beginning to get reviewed in art magazines, and his art was becoming as well known as his music.
01. Do we know for sure what time Daniel's actually going to play? I sort of said around 9. Yeah, okay. Yeah, 9. We're at the corner of Melrose and La Brea. He's here right now.
You going to get some tape done and we can get started?
The hardest thing to find in art is somebody that comes up with something new, somebody completely original.
No, it's double stick, so you can put it on the back.
I'm not looking for people that are part of movements that much. I'm more interested in people who are their own movement, or they're moving beyond any movement, or, you know, are doing things that no movement has thought of. I think Daniel Johnston is his own movement. He's doing things as original in his way as Joseph Cornell did, or Westerman, or even going back to Marcel Duchamp or Man Ray, or somebody that just comes up with stuff that, you know, who would have thought it? Well, I think it's wrong to put him in that outsider art thing. He's as much as inside as any major artist. He's just going in his own direction, doing his own thing, which more artists should do.
An unidentified collector has just bought 98% of the show. And the show has not even started yet.
We've sold practically every drawing that he brought, except for 4. That's what happened so far. And the show has just... You know, nobody showed up yet, you know. We're going to have to start taking orders, I guess. I mean, last year his stuff sold pretty fast, but not this fast.
Yeah, there's some themes, you know. I mean, with the artwork, I do some Captain America's, you know, some ducks. I do a lot of ducks, and they're like my armies, and sometimes I use them in my battles against Satan.
Daniel's art mirrors his songwriting in many ways. The same characters, the same themes. There are plenty of drawings that refer to unrequited love. You'll find the same characters such as Casper the Friendly Ghost, Captain America, Frankenstein appears quite often. You have Joe the Boxer and the eternal struggle, the eternal battle. For 2 years, all Daniel drew were fight scenes of a boxer fighting a creature in the ring. The boxer clearly represented Daniel while the creature was evil. This was Vile Corrupt from the Hi, How Are You album. The piece titled Daniel Johnston's Symbolical Visions is in many ways the Rosetta Stone of Daniel's art. It has all the figures and symbols that appear in so many of his drawings, from Kathy McCarty's glasses to a baby block to the man with the sawed-off head to torsos. All of the familiar figures are there, 666, eyes, the pyramid. If you listen to all of Daniel's music and know the songs and then look at the drawings, they have added meaning.
Sometimes very hard to fathom what goes on in his mind. I can see what he's thinking just day by day in his drawings. He will put captions on his drawings that are coming right from deep inside. And by looking over his shoulder every day, I can get a little bit of what goes on in his mind.
A friend of mine that saw his art that's in the mental health field said, I know Daniel's going to heaven. He's already been to hell. She was looking at the artwork, and she said, this is hellacious. I mean, someone tortured. And I don't even see it that way. A lot of his artwork I see is very happy, and he really believes in love. I think he looks for that superhero idea of someone's going to rescue or save and be the good guy.
It's not really a coincidence, but I did a tribute album of Daniel's songs, and later I went on to marry Daniel's best friend. The very first time I went to Daniel's apartment, Daniel handed me a book of poetry and said, oh, you might like this. These are my friend Dave's poems. Why don't you read them? And I loved them. He was instantly my favorite poet. 2 or 3 years after Dead Dog's Eyeball came out, Dave emailed me and said, hi, this is Dave Thornberry. Do you remember me? And I wrote him back like, do I remember you? I read your poems all the time still. And I went to visit him, and as soon as we were together, it was like, we have to get married. And we did, and it was very romantic. We got married 2 days after we saw each other for the first time in 13 years.
I remembered everything through all that time that I lost contact with you. I was with Kathy, and my mind was turning inside and out, thinking about Kathy. I'm kinder to her, Dave, than anybody. Never hurt her. And you're a lucky soul, David.
Daniel never really talked to me directly about Lori. But of course I knew that all the songs were about someone. I mean, I knew that he had loved and lost, you know, in his life. And I don't think I even ever really thought that all the songs were about the same person. But after we had broke up, so to speak, I began to know more about Lori. He talked more about Lori. And I began to know, like, how huge an obsession his obsession with Lori was.
Love could save me somehow, but I just can't make it.
Most of my songs are about her, you know, because she does, did, and hopefully will love me, you know, it keeps me going. I'm always thinking about another angle about it when I'm writing a song. I think art has always been inspired by beauty. I think there have been many artists throughout history who had a major inspiration, whether it was a girl or even just a philosophy. That's what I like about life and about art, is that when you write a song, it's just the way that you saw it or just the way that it was. I think art is the greatest frame of mind to express a certain feeling, and you always have that feeling. It's always there.
So magical.
Lori is his muse, but in a completely passive way. Lori is the 17 syllables of haiku for him to hang his creativity on. That's what she is. She's a structure for him to build on. She's not the love of his life, I mean, but she is.
When I first met Daniel in 85, he was burning with her. I mean, she was in his eyes all the time. I mean, when he talked about her, it was just intense. And what's so weird about Daniel is that went away, and it came back more intense later on because he realized it was a really good story.
True love will find you in the end. You'll find out just who was your friend. Don't be sad, I know you will. But don't give up until true love will find you in the end. This is a promise with a catch. Only if you're looking can it find you?
recognize you unless you step out into the light, the light. Don't be sad, I know you will. But don't give up until true love will find you in the end.
For as much as Daniel has expanded the myth of Lori, it really wasn't that big of a deal, except in Daniel's mind. But what happened with Jeff really was a big deal. And as far as like a story that breaks your heart, that's the story that breaks my heart about Daniel's life.
Daniel told me that he was sorry about the way he had treated me, and he admitted that I had been unjustly fired, and he told me that he was not right mentally at that time. And he really said all the things you would hope to hear from somebody who had behaved the way he had behaved. He was very sincere, and I believe he truly felt bad about the way things went down between the two of us. Even though I wasn't his manager, I still had the back catalog, and I couldn't just stop. It just made no sense. I didn't know what would happen with this music. It would have disappeared forever. It wouldn't exist today if I stopped. Stress Records is my baby. It's a company I started about 23 years ago, and today it exists for the sole purpose of spreading the word of Daniel Johnston to the masses. I do that by dubbing his cassettes and distributing them myself. I advertise them over the internet. I take mail orders daily. I work the telephones. I send them out to people I know. I do everything I can. I do it because people need to hear this music. The music of Daniel Johnston is something that I think everybody needs to at least be exposed to. There's really nothing to even compare it to. It goes way beyond Dylan's basement recordings or early Robert Johnson or any other body of work that I can think of.
Daniel's been so much better these last few years. It's a miracle. It's even difficult for me to grasp the fact that he's playing internationally and touring.
Okay, we got a sing-along. We hope you know it.
Daniel's life, everywhere he's gone, he leaves this incredible wake behind of creation and destruction. He's done all kinds of things, both bad and good, but they're all mythic, and they're all barely believable, yet they're all true. And the kinds of things that he's done in his career, the kinds of things someone would only do if they were so self-sabotaging that it was completely mystifying. But in terms of creating a legend, he's done absolutely everything right.
He was smiling through his own personal hell. Dropped his last dime down a wishing well. But he was hoping too close, and then he fell. Now he's Casper, the friendly ghost. He was always polite to the people who tell him that he was nothing but a lazy bum. But goodbye to them, he had to go. Now he's Casper.
Is Matt Groening here tonight in the audience somewhere?
And somebody said, you got to listen to this guy. And I said, well, which tape should I get? And I was told all of them. And that's right. They're all fantastic.
There's more comics now than there ever been before. And the Simpsons comic looks great.
Thank you.
I love that. And the superhero with the guy turns into...
Should be a Daniel Johnston comic this book.
Yeah,
that's true. I want to do comics, but that's what I'm shooting for.
Good to see you. I'll see you around. I got to go see your show. Fantastic.
Okay, well,
keep up the fantastic work. Call me.
I want to do some music for you, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, it's a deal.
All right.
See you.
Bye-bye. Good luck.
You too.
Okay. Yeah!
And so the legend grew, and all the people that he knew go and spread the news of
flat. Thank you.
I don't think Dan would have gotten as far as he did without our help. And he, his own words was, I don't know what will happen to me if you don't help me. So we have for years.
He does love us. I can see that. I guess I want the impossible. I want Dan to be whole and be able to take care of himself.
And we're worried now we're running out of time.
Something lasts a long time.